This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Sister Helen Prejean, has written a new spiritual memoir. You may know her as the author of the earlier memoir, Dead Man Walking, about how she became an activist against the death penalty. In 1982, she became a spiritual advisor to a convicted killer on death row. She since accompanied six people to their execution. Dead Man Walking was adapted into a 1995 film starring Susan Sarandon, who won an Oscar for her portrayal of Helen Prejean. In Sister Helen's new memoir, River of Fire, she tells the story of her spiritual journey and her awakening to social justice movements. She entered the convent in 1957, joining the Congregation of St. Joseph. Just a few years later, beginning in 1962, her life was opened up by the reforms of Vatican II, the 21st Ecumenical Council of the Roman Catholic Church. It wasn't until the 80s that she started to see her role as being with the poor and imprisoned. Her book ends with her letter to Pope Francis, which she personally delivered to him, in which she shares her concern about the wound she believes infects every aspect of church life, the way the church treats women. Sister Helen Prejean, welcome back to Fresh Air. You had not planned to be a social activist nun. You hadn't planned on being an anti-death penalty activist. What did you imagine being a nun would be like when you joined the Congregation of Sisters of St. Joseph at age 18?
Well, it was what the Holy Rule said and what convent life was like before Vatican II. You join the religious life to seek a spiritual life of perfection, of union with God, love of neighbor. But you were semi-cloistered. You never ate with lay people where you taught at the school. It was a daily regimen of prayers, a lot of vocal prayers, the rosary, litanies. But precious in the day were 2 half-hour periods of silence where you could have meditation. And so it was under this strict thing of canon law for all religious women, which had come out in 1949, strict thing of the way that you got to holiness was by obedience to superiors. So no questioning, it was called blind obedience. And by being obedient, that was how you got holy. You gave up self-will. And in the process, as I experienced it, you also began to give up a lot of thinking, critical thinking, because you knew what you had to do was conform in the end to whatever was being asked of you. And that is what I entered into. I wanted to be a mystic.
So did you feel that blind obedience and a lack of critical thinking were leading you closer to the mystical state that you wanted to be in, that you imagined being a nun would lead you closer to?
I just want to tell you, I tried hard. I really did. But what I began to experience just existentially inside myself was I was giving up critical thinking. It was whatever mother says has got to be what it is. And then you just follow the rule.
Mother superior, and, not your mother.
Yeah. No, mother spirit. That's right. In religious life, you call superiors mother. And I began to find that it was kind of a quietism. It was kind of, well, I'm praying, but I wasn't intellectually stirred, and I began to find it very confining. Luckily, I wasn't in it that long, like just 5 years before Vatican II happened in the church and opened up doors of inquiry, exploration, and relating to the world.
So yeah. You're talking about how nuns were treated. Now, compare nuns to priests. Like, you write that in the spiritual manuals of the day before Vatican II, that topping the list of womanly virtues was obedience, submission, and resignation. So that's what you were supposed to practice. What about people who, like men who were becoming priests? Was there an emphasis for them on obedience, submission, and resignation?
They had to give obedience to a bishop. But they were much more freewheeling, and they didn't make a vow of poverty. So they had money. If their family had money, they could have cars, they could have a boat, they could have a condominium. It was just like they were much more freewheeling, and they would make decisions and act out of them. But their life was not in community the way ours was as sisters. I found them often very lonely And I mean, I even heard that in some rectories, you had your individual salt and pepper shaker by your place. And loneliness is not good for people. I don't think you can make it in the Christian life. I don't think you can make it in human life without a community of people to share with. So that was a downside for them.
Mm-hmm.
They were also trained in the early days. Like I talk about my pastor, Paul Raymond Moore, when I was the director of religious ed in a parish in New Orleans. He never, ever looked into my eyes. He had been trained never to look into the eyes of a woman. And I also learned that the way priests would shake hands with a woman is they'd take your hand, and then they would like bend your hand with the wrist outward so you couldn't come in close, lest, God forbid, they got a bosomly hug.
Hmm. Let's talk about what you had to wear before Vatican II. What was it like wearing the habit? How did it feel? Did you feel like it was separating you from the world or just giving you a kind of uniform that told the world who you were and that got respect?
Well, in a Catholic context, and you got to know that during this time, the religious women, religious orders, were the ones that made the Catholic institutions run, the whole educational system and hospitals. So in a Catholic context, people were used to the habit. They saw it as a object of respect. And traditional Catholics found it very hard when we took the habit off. But the habit, because you got to get this, Terry, it was 3.5 yards of black wool serge wrapped around your body, everything covered. You not only had long flowing sleeves, but you had what was called undersleeves. You not only had a long black flowing veil, but you had a underveil. And you had what was called a coronet around your neck and 3 other pieces of cloth on your head so that you were, let's just say, you were covered. In fact, one of our sisters one time, she was in this material store cloth, and she was standing there and she felt somebody pulling on her veil. And she turned around to this surprised lady who thought she was a bolt of material. Well, in a way, she was. How are you going to know she's not a bolt of material with all that black? That's all you saw.
And New Orleans is hot and humid.
Oh, God. You want to—I mean, we had a funny sister, Gert, and she got on the bus one day. One of the ladies on the bus in New Orleans, it's July. And the lady said, oh, look at those sisters. They always look as crisp and fresh as daisies. And Gert leans over and whispers to the sister next to her, kid, what is that rolling down my leg? You sweat. You were in a puddle. It was really, really hot. But you know what? It's interesting how you adapt to things. So you expect it to be hot. You moved into that. And so in the summer, you were hot.
You entered the convent when you were in your late teens. This was just a few years before Vatican II, which initiated really groundbreaking reforms in the Catholic Church. You say, at last we got to reclaim our humanness, all of it, including our physical selves, our bodies, our desires, even our sexuality. I was surprised to see sexuality in
yeah,
that sentence.
Of course you were. Of course you were.
Coming from a nun, yeah.
Well, of course sexuality. You know, sexuality is present in us in a lot of ways. It's not just having genital sex with people. Sexuality is part of our being. So the sexuality.
But I always thought that's a part of the being you were supposed to suppress if you were a nun.
Well, acting out of sexuality where you've made a vow of celibacy and here you are having affairs and having sex, that's not integral. That's not transparent. That's not true. But so, of course, when we never talked about sexuality. Everything was sublimate, 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 which means you just offer it to God. But sexuality is our body. It's ourself. It's part of who we are. So the challenge of celibacy is it's not to love anyone or not to love in friendship, but you know that one of the levees around your river is that you will not go into full sexual expression with someone. And one of the reasons for that is because it's so self-absorbing and it closes you off, because if you're in a sexual relationship with somebody and that intimate a relationship, that's priority in your life, and you cannot simultaneously in your life be open to a whole lot of people. That's the challenge of celibacy. But not to live this shriveled up life where you're not close to anybody.
Mm-hmm. So you met a priest when you were in your 20s, and you were at the time studying together. And he fell in love with you, and I think you fell in love with him. But of course, you wanted to observe the vow of chastity. And you're right that this relationship was an example of what was being called the third way. Would you describe what the third way was?
Sure. And if you remember my description, that we would live our vows, but we would be close as man and woman, as friends.
Mm-hmm.
And then I say in the book, if you think that sounds tricky and confusing, that's because it is. So, of course, when sister said freedom and priests and you'd be going away to study, as happened with me when I went to London, Ontario, it was a school of religious education. And you had priests and nuns, a few lay people, going to school together. And that's how I met William's, not his real name. I wanted to protect him. He has died, and I want to make sure that I protected him in every way. And he was so attractive. He was handsome. He had a great mind. And we were immediately drawn to each other. But then we are going over to Dennis's house, who had a piano. And there was beer and wine and hard liquor. And so we're sipping our drinks and we're singing songs around the piano. And some of them were love songs, like Somewhere My Love. There will be songs to sing, the theme from Zhivago, which had come out around that time. And the next thing you know, you're looking at each other and you're going, oh my God. And that attraction was there, the sexual attraction. You couldn't help it. So then there's that discernment again in prayer. What's going on here? What's going on here? So I knew my soul, and I knew that I was not on a path that I'm going to fall in love with somebody and marry them. I was clear about that. I wanted to be able to live a lifestyle that I could be wide in the number of people, or the way I could reach out to people in love and service. That is a gift of the sisterhood, by the way, that you are free after Vatican II to do work you want to do, and mm-hmm. you can follow your deepest desires and your gifts as a self.
Well, a problem in the relationship, too, was that he started drinking a lot too much, and that you found that very troubling. And you broke off the relationship. Do you think he wanted to marry you and leave the priesthood and have you leave?
Absolutely.
The order?
Uh-huh. Well, that was clear.
Uh-huh.
And especially when we're together and he'd be coming on strong to me. I mean, sometimes, thank God I was physically fit. I mean, when he was drinking, it was not pleasant at all. Then he'd be so apologetic. And I didn't know how alcohol worked. But he was so apologetic. And he'd say, he would call me Lou. My name was Louis Augustine. We dropped all the men's names after Vatican II became our baptismal name ourselves. Oh, Lou, I'm so sorry. You know I want you to be free, to be who you want to be. And then he'd be so contrite that I thought it would never happen again. I didn't know how alcohol worked.
Mm-hmm.
I also began to see how terribly lonely he was in the priesthood. It is one of my concerns for priests,
mm-hmm.
that so many of them are lonely because they don't have the same kind of community.
At the end of the book, you publish a letter that you wrote to Pope Francis. And you made a very stirring argument on behalf of more equality for nuns.
And for women in the church, not just nuns.
Yeah, for women in the church, including nuns. And one of your arguments is, how can men really understand the world if women aren't their equals? And that applies to nuns and priests. And you also write about how you can preach in Protestant churches, but not in your own. You could give sermons in Protestant churches against the death penalty. And even though the Pope opposes the death penalty, you can't give the same sermon in your own Catholic church.
Women can't preach in the Catholic Church. Women cannot read the gospel at Mass. A young little pimply teenager who happens to be a boy could read the gospel. We got to be male. And see the million ways it plays out that women somehow cannot fully image Christ. It was what I said in the letter was that women need to be in on those decision-making councils when policies are being decided in the church, because the presence of women, our consciousness, our empathy, what we bring to the table is really important for the dialogue. And if men in the church are always only talking to other men at the top decision-making levels, and that's the Curia in Rome, that's the bishops when they meet, it's always all males. And that if we don't have full dialogue with women represented, that's the fullness of human beings, we are never going to be able to embody what the gospel of Jesus is about.
Didn't Pope Francis recently affirm that one thing that was not going to change was women being restricted from becoming priests?
Yes, he has said that.
So you still think it's going to change eventually, but not in the near future,
just because that life moves and the spirit in the church. Look how long it took, 1,600 years, to change the teaching of the Catholic Church on the death penalty to unequivocal opposition. So women, it's going to change because it has to, because it's so against the gospel of Jesus to simply say because someone is a man or a woman, one can fully represent Christ and so represent him at the altar and the other one can't.
Yeah.
I mean, the more women are educated, the more people are educated, they're going to question that. Now, how do you love your church and raise the questions? You do that because you do love your church. It's why I carried on dialogue with the church for over 30 years about the death penalty question. You keep the dialogue going. You keep raising the questions, and people's experience keeps bubbling up. So here's a parish. There's a young girl that wants to be an altar server, and there's a traditionalist priest says no girls can. And so here we go. The bubbles are rising in the pot.
At the end of your book, you write that you are now 80. Your parents died when they were 81. Your older sister is dead. And you write, death seems to be such a crapshoot. Either it's everything, union and love with all that is, or it's nothing, disintegration into a puny pile of chemicals. How has your understanding of death changed in all the years that you've been a nun?
Well, in watching people actually go to their death, I've seen how they summon their courage to make the walk. They're very afraid, but they do it. They do it. I've watched Mama, Daddy, Marianne. It's Marianne and I are really close. And in fact, after Marianne died,
your sister, yeah.
Yeah, my sister, she was always a brave one, like when we were doing tomboy things, like jumping from a limb to catch a rope swing. I'm the last one on the branch. And she's going, Ellen, jump, don't be such a sissy. So the words that came up inside me after she had died, because she was gone then, I couldn't hear her voice physically, was, sis, death comes for everybody. I did it. It's going to happen to you too. Don't be a sissy. I had what it took. God brought me through it. And you'll have what you need too, and it strengthens me.
Do you believe in a literal heaven and hell?
What do you mean by literal?
That there actually is a heaven, and that some people will be dispatched to heaven and some people will be scorched eternally in hell.
I do not believe that if we say God is a loving and merciful God, that God puts people in this frying pan and zaps them in fire for all eternity, plunges them into an eternal pain. That what kind of God is that? It's mystery, of course, but I know that it cannot be the imposition of eternal pain. At least it doesn't, with anything I know about the God, the Abba that Jesus taught us, and that God is merciful. What does it mean to say God's merciful? You can keep people in a frying pan in hell for all eternity. Heaven, a little imagination here. What if heaven What if Marianne is right here by my side, but I can't see her? Mom and Daddy, all those. It's called the Communion of Saints in the Catholic Church. Not that it's a literal place, of course, but what if they have crossed over a threshold in which they have moved into a way of being that is somehow connected in love with everything? And maybe that is the heart of what it all means.
Sister Helen Prejean, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Terry, I love hearing that voice come on the radio. It's been a joy. Thank you so much for getting this book out, because it's really important we get religion right. Because God, you know, religion's used in so many ways to hurt people, especially Christianity.
Do you feel like you're seeing that right now?
I'll give one example. Jeff Sessions, before him Justice Scalia, quoting Romans 13, that if anything is the law in the United States, we obey civil authority because it has the authority of God. And Justice Scalia quoted that to justify the death penalty. And Jeff Sessions just quoted that because it's the law for people to enter the country illegally, so you can separate children from their parents. And he brought in divine authority to sanction it. And that is really, really harmful. It is so opposite to the compassion and mercy and love that Jesus taught us that it just, I can't tell you what it does to see that happening over and over again by these people who claimed Christianity and then quote even the words of Jesus sometimes to hurt people, to disrespect them, and to claim that this suffering we're causing of separating children from their parents is really God's will because it's legal. And I'll quote Thomas Merton, the Trappist monk, but I still make retreat with the Trappist monks at Gethsemane, who said, when the world ends, it'll be legal.
Sister Helen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
Sister Helen Prejean's new memoir is called River of Fire. The first release from Barack and Michelle Obama's new production company, Higher Ground Productions, is now on Netflix. It's called American Factory, and it won the directing award at this year's Sundance Film Festival. Directed by Julia Reichert and Stephen Bogner, this documentary shows what happened when a Chinese company opened a factory in Ohio. Our critic at large, John Power, says it's a smart, compassionate look at work in the age of globalization.
In the 1960s, there was a terrific comedy in which a teenage Maoist scrawled a bit of graffiti that would become famous. China is near. Half a century on, China is here. It's here on our screens where Hong Kong protests domination by the communist mainland. It's here in the tariff war between President Trump and Chairman Xi. And of course, it's here inside the cell phones we all worship. China's arrival in the American workplace is the subject of a fine new Netflix documentary, American Factory, by Julia Reichert and Stephen Bogner, who spent years chronicling blue-collar lives. Set on the outskirts of their home city of Dayton, Ohio, this measured, deeply moving film takes a familiar idea, the notion of an American factory, and shows how tricky that concept has become in today's globalized economy. The story begins with a 2008 prologue in which General Motors shutters its Moraine, Ohio plant, chucking 2,400 union workers out of work and into years of desperate struggle. Then in 2015 comes hope. The Chinese company Fuyao, which makes glass for automobiles, decides to reopen the plant and hire 1,000 locals. Led by its self-made billionaire owner, Chairman Cao, who looks, alas, like a caricature of a fat cat tycoon, Fuyao brings along 200 experienced Chinese employees to oversee production. At first, things go okay. True, a worker like Shanae Rosser is making only $12.84 an hour, way down from the $28 an hour she earned at GM. And true, the Chinese are frustrated that the Americans work so slowly. They have fat fingers, one says. Still, everyone wants the factory to succeed. furnace supervisors like Rob Hare and Wong He become friends, while others seek to understand their cultural differences. And when it comes to work, these are profound. We see this in two contrasting Fuyao celebrations. In the first, a few Ohio workers fly to China and watch the company's New Year festivities. A heavily scripted display of totalitarian kitsch, complete with dancing girls and little kids singing about teamwork and corporate success. The second is the American factory's opening ceremony, at which Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown startles and enrages Cao and his American execs by saying he hopes the plant will be unionized. If you think American capitalists don't like unions, try the Chinese communists. While Americans expect 8-hour days with vacations and benefits, Fuyao management is used to Chinese employees who work 12-hour shifts with one day off a month, often sharing dorm-like apartments. The bosses think Americans lazy for talking on the job. Meanwhile, the Americans grow dispirited by the relentless factory regimen, as one of them tells us in a tone that speaks volumes.
The conditions are not favorable. Doing the same thing over and over again, that wears on your body, mind, your soul. It's sometimes you think, why am I doing this? You think about whether you have the stamina and the will to do this type of job.
Reichert and Bogner are clearly on the side of the workers, both American and Chinese. Yet their film is no Michael Moore polemic. It's an old-school observational documentary in the very best sense of the term. They don't approach the Fuyao story with a thesis, don't dehumanize the Chinese, don't tell us what to think. Working with 1,200 hours of footage, heroically edited by Lindsay Utz, they have amazing access to a complex economic reality that's touchingly hard on workers like Jill Lamantia, John Crane, and Timmy Jernigan, to name a few more key characters. Eventually, many of Fuyao's American workers get fed up with the factory's cramped, hectoring conditions. I won't say what happens, but watching events play out is an education in the workings of the global economy. From the factory floor to the boardroom, everyone is caught in the logic of the market, which defines everything in terms of the bottom line. If you don't help maximize profit, you're gone. We're not surprised when Cao starts to replace his workers with robots. Reichert and Bogner capture a reality facing millions of Americans. Even as their wages go down and they long for the comfortable lives folks like them once could afford, workers in China, whose low pay has driven down wages all over the Western world, enjoy a prosperity they've never before known. Life's looking rosier for them. Their 12-hour workday, without time off or benefits, represents the rising model of labor in 21st century capitalism. Near the end of American Factory, Chairman Cao strolls outside a glassy pillared mansion that contains what looks like a shrine to himself. The point of living is to work, he says. Don't you think so? It's hard to think of a sadder or scarier line in any movie this year.
John Powers reviewed the new documentary American Factory, which is streaming on Netflix. Coming up, we hear from cardiologist Heide Verreich, author of the new book State of the Heart, exploring the history, science, and future of cardiac disease. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Breakthroughs in heart medicine, including surgical procedures, devices, and medications, have changed how various forms of heart disease are treated and enabled many people to live longer lives. We're going to hear about some of those new developments from Heide Verreich, author of the new book State of the Heart, exploring the history, science, and future of cardiac disease. We're also going to talk about cholesterol and blood pressure. Verreich previously joined us to talk about his book Modern Death, How Medicine Changed the End of Life. He's a cardiologist who began his medical training in Pakistan, where he's from, and continued his training in cardiology at Harvard Medical School and Duke University. He just joined the faculty of Brigham and Women's Hospital at Harvard Medical School and the Boston VA. Dr. Harder Verreich, welcome back to Fresh Air. You write that during the time that you were a medical student, you saw so many changes in heart medicine and technology. Tell us about one that you think is most significant.
When I was a medical resident, this was around the time when a new device had just started to be used in clinical practice that I had really never heard about before. And this was a device called a left ventricular assist device. And really what it is it is a mechanical pump that can be sewn directly right into a patient's heart and basically takes over the pumping function of the heart. And I know when this program started, there was a specific row in the hospital, in the wards, where these patients would be taken care of. And at least initially, residents were not even allowed to take care of these patients. So they had this aura, this mystery to them. But the interesting thing about this therapy is that it fundamentally changes so many of the things what we consider to be, you know, the key fundamental principles of being a human being. So, you know, these patients who had these mechanical pumps, you know, they didn't have a pulse. If you perform CPR on them, it could actually do more harm than good. And these patients were basically dependent on their batteries for their life. So this was such a dramatic departure from really any type of other medical intervention that I'd ever even heard about. Which is, you know, part of the reason why I actually pursued this and now I actually specialize in taking care of these patients.
Yes, and you describe this device, which is an LVAD, which stands for left ventricular assist device. You describe it as representing the dawn of a new era in human life, the union of man and machine. Because you're totally dependent on the machine, I mean, every second of the day. But really the idea of like no pulse, it's like hard for me to conceive of that.
I mean, it's hard as a physician. I mean, checking someone's pulse is part of the, you know, one of the sort of purest and oldest rituals in medicine. When you come up to someone, you shake their hands and you're examining them, and you almost always start by checking the pulse in their wrist. And the other thing that happens in these patients is that if you put a stethoscope to their chest, usually you'll hear the, you know, the gallop of the heart kind of, you know, running away as it has been since, you know, we were in our mother's womb. But you don't really hear the heart sounds. All you hear is this mechanical pump kind of whirring away, pushing blood to every part of the body. It really is a surreal experience the first time you experience a patient with an LVAD as a physician. And I can't even imagine what it must be like to have one.
Why don't you have a pulse when your blood is being pumped by the LVAD device?
So the reason we have a pulse is because the heart beats rhythmically, you know, beat by beat. And with every beat, it sends a pulsation through the body that can be felt as a pulse. But the VAD, the motor, is just continuous. So because it's continuous, there's no pulsation to be felt in most patients.
It's not pumping. It's a continuous flow.
It's a continuous flow.
Isn't another strange thing about this device, and again, I found this really hard to imagine, you write about a patient whose device was still pumping blood even though the patient had died.
So, you know, LVADs are really a great therapy. I've seen them really transform some patients' lives. It's allowed a lot of patients to, you know, live parts of their life that they may never have been able to attend grandchildren's graduations or bar mitzvahs or do really, really important things that they would not have been able to were it not for the device. But it does in some ways represent a turning point in what it means to be human. You know, I think you look at TV and, you know, everyone is talking about this distant future in which we'll be transhuman. But if you're a cardiologist like me and you take care of these patients with VADs, you know that transhumanism has arrived. And it affects us, and especially for these patients who are dependent on these machines, it's a central part of their life. But not just their life, but also at the end of their life. So one of the things that LVADs make a bit hard is that, you know, the LVAD separates the heart from the rest of the body, because the rest of your body is still mortal, while the LVAD in some ways has removed that feature from your heart because it'll keep pumping as long as it has power and has battery life. So when patients do, in fact, pass away, it may be that their LVAD is still functioning and it has to be turned off, which is, again, something that is so foreign to really anything else that I'd ever done. But it is a really important part of taking care of these patients. A lot of patients who get LVADs, they get it, and those things will stay in them until they pass away.
There's another breakthrough in heart medicine that happened while you were a medical student. In fact, you witnessed it. And I'm thinking of aortic valve surgery. You observed the first time a transcatheter aortic valve was placed in a patient in a minimally invasive procedure. Tell us about this procedure.
So one of the things that is a disease that's fairly common is called aortic stenosis. So the aortic valve is the last door that the blood has to leave before it leaves the heart and enters the rest of the body, starting with the aorta, which is the greatest vessel in your body. Over time, this valve can sometimes get thickened, and it can basically cause an obstruction of blood flow, basically raising the pressure that is needed for blood to leave the heart. And it can be a fatal diagnosis. And initially, before like 1950s, we really didn't have any treatment for it. But then the sort of revolution in cardiac surgery meant that now people who had aortic stenosis, especially if it was severe, it could be repaired with surgery. But then starting in Europe, physicians and researchers started to think about, you know, how can we do this better? How can we help patients with aortic stenosis without having to necessarily cut their chest open? You can replace the aortic valve without doing surgery through small catheters that are inserted through your leg or other blood vessel. And it's transformed the treatment of aortic valves surgery. And I was a researcher up in Boston when one of the first few of these devices were ever implanted in the United States. And I don't think anyone could have ever imagined at that point just how revolutionary this treatment might be. In fact, the most famous TAVR patient is actually Mick Jagger. He just had a severe aortic stenosis, and he underwent this TAVR procedure. And within days of this, he shared this video on Twitter in which he was back, doing his act, dancing, and in fact, he was back doing a concert just a few days ago. And this was unimaginable, I would say, even, you know, a few years ago, that we would be able to transform treatment in a way that no one could have really imagined. And this is what's really one of the really interesting things about heart disease, is that even though it doesn't get as much attention as so many other diseases, the advances that we have seen and the advances that we keep seeing in this area are just extremely fascinating, and to me represent the pinnacle, one of the pinnacles of human achievement.
The most low-tech version of diagnosing a heart attack is what is described as the eyeball test, which you say is really important in diagnosing a heart attack. What's the eyeball test?
Well, the eyeball test is, you walk into a patient's room and you just eyeball them and get all the sort of information you need from them based on just a visual inspection. Do they look gray? Are they sitting up, breathing comfortably? Are they, lurched over? It is inevitable that we use a test on really every patient, but it fails a lot of people. It's really not a great substitute for all the additional information that we have. And the eyeball test is also one of the things that introduces a lot of bias. So for example, the eyeball test fails a lot of women with heart disease, because I think so many of us, both physicians, nurses, as well as patients themselves, have been trained to think of heart disease as purely a man's disease, as a disease of middle-aged or older men. And I think, which is why, if we just rely on visual inspection, and we are actually opening ourselves up to a bias in which we might, incorrectly assume that a woman who is having difficult breathing or having chest pain probably is not having a heart attack or any type of heart disease. And this has been something that's been a really historic wrong that I hope that we can overcome.
While we're on the subject of women and heart disease, how do women's symptoms present differently than men's sometimes?
So this is a bit controversial, but, you know, but women are more likely to have what's called atypical symptoms, which include symptoms other than your classic chest pain. This could include, you know, even nausea, vomiting, stomach pains, you know, things that we don't usually necessarily associate with heart disease. I mean, some studies have shown that not to be the case, but I think that overall there is consensus that women are more likely to have these atypical symptoms. And what that does is that not only does it throw off the physician or the nurse or the paramedic who's taking care of these patients, it can throw off the patient as well. You know, patients who don't have classic chest pain are less likely to come to the hospital in a timely way. They're more likely to delay care, and that can have really bad consequences downstream.
When we last spoke in late January of 2017, this was shortly after Donald Trump was inaugurated, your father couldn't get a visa to visit you in the U.S., and your mother, who had a visa, was denied entry to the U.S., and this was during the Obama administration, and she was told she had to get a new visa, and then she was rejected when she applied for it. Are their visa statuses still the same?
Their visa statuses are still the same. My parents have applied multiple times and have been denied visas. But we're hoping that will change. In fact, just today I'd be filling out the form to apply for U.S. citizenship. And my hope is that, and I will pray and that application gets accepted and that we're able to sponsor our parents. But there is a lot of uncertainty. There are a lot of things that we just can't take for granted. The only thing I can hope for and pray for is for my parents' health while we wait for this process. But yes, it's been difficult. My parents can't visit. But we're hoping that will change in the future.
Were they ever given reasons for their visas being denied?
They have never been given a reason. And it's not for lack of trying. And this is the, they have talked to people, they have done multiple interviews. They have never been given a single reason. And that's part of the frustration that we face, is that we just don't know what we are up against. We don't know what we can do to rectify. I mean, these are people whose, you know, all their children are in the United States, all, you know, green card holders, all of them, you know, serving this community. All of them, good citizens, and yet they, for, you know, reasons that we don't know, are not even allowed to come and see the homes that we have built here. It's a shame, and it's a real tragedy.
So you're applying for citizenship. Your parents don't have visas, but you hope after you become a citizen, you'll be able to sponsor them and bring them here. But your daughter was born here, so she is a citizen. So what's it like for you to have a daughter who is a citizen of the United States while you're trying to become one?
America is more than just a country. It's an idea. And the idea is that you can come here and you can succeed and become a part of this society and not only help yourself, but help everyone you touch and help this community grow. And I feel like through my work, I've been able to do that in a very direct way. You know, a lot of people get embarrassed when, you know, someone asks them, where are you from? And I wait for that question. I wait for someone to ask me where I'm from so I can tell them I'm from Pakistan so that they know that there's a Pakistani who's there amongst them, who's there to help, who's there to love, and who's here to help not just this country, but this idea continue to grow, that this is a place where you can come from. Doesn't matter how much money is in your pocket or who you know, you can succeed and you can serve. And I hope that my daughter can be a part of this idea, and so can we.
Meanwhile, I think a lot of us have heard President Trump at a campaign rally talking about four new women members of Congress, women of color, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley, and Rashida Tlaib. Three of them born in America, all are citizens, And he, during the rally, was saying things that many people have interpreted as racist about them. And the people in the audience were chanting, "Send her back, send her back." As an immigrant from Pakistan, trying to become a citizen now, what goes through your mind when you hear that chant?
It's gut-wrenching. And when I saw that video, I didn't have the stomach to open it. Also because, you know, like so many others, I have heard that myself. My wife has heard that herself. She has heard that from people who are governmental officials, not just people that on the street. But at the same time, I also know of people who lined up airports when the Muslim ban was first considered. I know of people who are rushing to the border to help immigrants. And this is the paradox of America, that at the same time, you have so many people who care so deeply about what makes this country beautiful and who have welcomed us and are welcoming millions more to come to this society, to be a part of it, and to grow here with them and help them grow as well. And this is one of the sort of fundamental schisms in what it means to be an immigrant, that you can succeed as much as you want professionally, but someone can come up and tell you to go home.
Haider Vereitch, thank you so much for joining us again. It was really good to talk with you.
Thank you, Terry.
Dr. Haider Vereitch is the author of State of the Heart, Exploring the History, Science, and Future of Cardiac Disease. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Roberta Shorrock, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.